Welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. The 9/11 Conspiracy, Part 1. One of the defining elements of the new millennium has been the terrorist attack in the United States on September 11, 2001. Four commercial airliners were hijacked, with two planes targeting New York City, the World Trade Center in particular. A third plane would target Pentagon in Washington, D.C., and the fourth flight target is unknown as it crashed in Pennsylvania after it was hijacked when the passengers decide to attempt to retake the airplane hijackers. I think most of us knew where we were when this happened. I was at work watching things play out on the CNN website. Before all this happened, the only thing that was on my mind was that I had to be home at 11 because the cable guy was to show up to install high-speed internet at my house, and this day would have such a profound effect on the United States. So to study this conspiracy, I decided to split it up into multiple parts. This show I'll run through a timeline of the significant events and then some of the primary conspiracies and just touch on secondary conspiracies. I've avoided references to media reports and events that do not support the significant events of that day. I will, in later podcasts, introduce the media reports and a few other minor incidences. My main reason to exclude these is that many of these items play more into the conspiracy side than the factual side of this event, and this timeline is based upon Wikipedia's version of the 9/11 timeline. So, 7:59, American Airlines Flight 11, a Boeing 767 carrying 81 passengers and 11 crew members, depart 14 minutes late from Logan International Airport in Boston, its destination being Los Angeles International Airport in Los Angeles, California. At 8:13, Flight 11 has its last routine communications with FAA's Boston Center. At 8:14, Flight 11 is hijacked. At the same time, United Airlines Flight 175, another fully fueled Boeing 767 carrying 56 passengers and 9 crew members, also depart from Logan International Airport in Boston. Its destination was also Los Angeles International Airport. 8:19, Betty Ong, a flight attendant on Flight 11, alerts American Airlines via airphone. The cockpit is not answering. Somebody stabbed in business class, and I think there's mace. That we can't breathe. I don't know. I think we're getting hijacked. She then tells of the stabbing of two flight attendants. At 8:20, the Federal Aviation Administration's Boston Flight Center controllers decide that Flight 11 has probably been hijacked. Again, at the same time, American Airlines Flight 77, a Boeing 757 with 58 passengers and 6 crew members, depart from Washington Dulles International Airport in Fairfax and Loudoun Counties, Virginia, for Los Angeles International Airport. At 8:21, Flight 11's transponder signal is turned off, but it can still be tracked via primary radar by Boston Center. 8:24, a radio transmission comes from Flight 11. We have some planes, just stay quiet and you'll be okay. We are returning to the airport. It is believed that Mohammed Atta mistakenly held the button directing his voice to radio rather than the plane's cabin as he intended. A few seconds later, Atta's voice says, "Nobody move. Everything will be okay. If you try to make any moves, you'll endanger yourself and the airplane. Just stay quiet." Air traffic controllers hear this transmission. There will be other similar transmissions, so I will not be mentioning them. I'll be addressing these as I begin to explore each conspiracy. 8:25, Boston Center flight controllers alert other flight control centers regarding Flight 11. NORAD is not yet alerted. 8:26:30, Flight 11 makes a 100-degree turn to the south, heading toward New York City. 8:34, Dan Bueno from Boston Center notifies the tower controller at Otis Air National Guard Base at Cape Cod of the hijacking of Flight 11. The controller directs Bueno to contact Northeast Air Defense Sector. This is NEADS, Eastern Air Defense Sector, the northeast sector of NORAD. The controller then notifies Otis Operations Center that a call from NEADS might be coming. Two F-15 pilots begin to suit up. 8:37, Flight 175 confirms sighting of hijacked Flight 11 to flight controllers, 10 miles to its south. 8:37:52, Boston Center Control notifies NEADS of the hijacking of Flight 11, the first notification received by NORAD that Flight 11 had been hijacked. The controller requests military help to intercept the jetliner. 8:41, FAA's New York Center requests information about Flight 11 over the radio. Flight 175 responds, we heard suspicious transmission on our departure out of Boston, with someone, sounds like someone keyed the mic and said, everyone, stay in your seats. New York Center acknowledges and says it will pass the information on. 8:42, United Airlines Flight 93, a Boeing 757, takes off with 37 passengers and 7 crew members from Newark International Airport, now Newark Liberty International Airport, bound from San Francisco International Airport, following a 40-minute delay due to congested runways. 4 hijackers are aboard. 8:42 to 8:46, approximate, Flight 175 is hijacked. 8:46, two F-15 fighter jets are ordered to scramble from Otis Air National Guard Base in Massachusetts intended to intercept Flight 11. Because Flight 11's transponder is off, the pilots do not know the location of their target. NEADS spends the next several minutes watching their radar screens in anticipation of Flight 11 returning a radar contact. 8:46:30, Flight 11 crashes at roughly 466 miles per hour. Into the north face of the North Tower, 1 WTC, of the World Trade Center, between floors 93 and 99. Many early accounts gave times between 8:45 and 8:50. The aircraft enters the tower intact. It plows into the building core, severing all 3 gypsum-encased stairwells, dragging combustibles with it. 8:46:43, Chief of New York City's Fire Department, 1st Battalion, Joseph Pfeiffer, makes the first fire department radio message advising the Fire Department New York Manhattan Fire Dispatch Office of crash. Chief Pfeiffer and personnel from other fire companies were several blocks north on the corner of Church Street and Lippensard Street investigating an odor of gas in the street and witnessed the attack along with the Naudette brothers who were accompanying the firefighters at the time. 8:48:08, the first television report of an incident at the World Trade Center is broadcast locally in New York City. And 8:49, the first network television and radio reports of an explosion or incident at the World Trade Center. CNN breaks into a DITAC commercial at 8:49. The CNN screen subtitle first reads World Trade Center Disaster. Carol Lynn, the first TV network anchor to break the news, attacks. 8:50, NEADS is notified that a plane has struck the World Trade Center as they continue to try to locate flight on radar. 8:50 to 8:54, approximately, Flight 77 is hijacked. 8:51, a flight controller at the FAA's New York Center notices that Flight 175 had changed its transponder code twice 4 minutes earlier. He tries to contact the flight. 8:52, the F-15s at Otis Air National Guard Base are airborne, still lacking an intercept vector to Flight 11 and not aware that it had already crashed. They are sent to a military-controlled airspace off Long Island in order to remain in a holding pattern until between 9:09 and 9:13. 8:54, Flight 77 deviates from its assigned course, turning south over Ohio. 8:55 approximately, announcements are made over the building-wide PA system by officials in the still undamaged South Tower of the World Trade Center, reporting that the building is secure and that people should return to their offices. Some do not hear it, others ignore it and evacuate anyway, others congregate in common areas like the 78th floor sky lobby. 8:55, President George W. Bush is at Emma E. Booker Elementary School in Sarasota, Florida, as part of a scheduled visit to promote education when the White House Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, who is with Bush, informs him that a small twin-engine plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. Before entering the classroom, the president speaks to National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice, who is at the White House. She first tells him that it was a twin-engine aircraft and then a commercial aircraft that had struck the World Trade Center, adding that, that is all we know right now, Mr. President. 8:56. 10 minutes after the North Tower of the World Trade Center was hit by Flight 11, the transponder on Flight 77 is turned off, and even primary radar with the aircraft is lost. During the radar blackout, Flight 77 turns east unnoticed by flight controllers. When the primary radar information is restored at 9:05, the controllers are searching for Flight 77 to the west of its previous position and are unable to find it. Flight 77 travels undetected for 36 minutes on a course heading due east toward Washington, D.C. 8:58, Flight 175 takes a heading toward New York City. At 9:01 to 9:02, a manager from the FAA's New York Center tells Air Traffic Control Systems Command Center in Herndon, Virginia, "We have several situations going on here. It's escalating big time. We need to get military involved with us. We're involved with something else. We have other aircraft that may have similar situations going on here." 9:01, FAA's New York Center contacts New York Terminal Approach Control and asks for help in locating Flight 175. 9:02, evacuation is ordered by the Fire Department of New York Battalion Chief Joseph Pfeiffer. An announcement is made over the PA system to evacuate the buildings. 9:03:02, Flight 75 crashes at about 590 miles an hour into the south face of the South Tower, 2WTC, of the World Trade Center, between floors 77 and 85. All 65 people on board of the aircraft die instantly on impact, and unknown hundreds in the building as well. By this time, several media organizations, including the three major broadcast networks who have interrupted their morning shows, are covering the first plane crash. Millions see the impact live. Parts of the plane, including the starboard engine, leave the building from the east and north sides, falling to the ground six blocks away. A massive evacuation begins in the South Tower below the impact zone. One of the stairwells in the South Tower remain unblocked from top to bottom of the tower because of the plane hitting at an offset from the vertical center line of the building, but it is filled with smoke. 9:03, President Bush enters a classroom as part of his school visit. Same time, FAA's New York Center notifies NORAD of the hijacking of Flight 175 at the same time it crashes. 9:04, approximately, the FAA's Boston Air Route Controller Center stops all departure from airports in its jurisdiction, New England and Eastern New York State. 9:05, after brief introductions to the Booker Elementary students, President Bush is about to begin reading The Pet Goat with students when Chief of Staff Andrew Card interrupts to whisper to the president, "A second plane has hit the second tower. America's under attack." The president stated later that he decided to continue the lesson rather than alarm the students. 9:06, the FAA bans takeoffs of all flights bound to or through the airspace of New York Center from airports in that center and the three adjacent centers, Boston, Cleveland, Washington. This is referred to as a first-tier ground stop and covers the northeast from North Carolina north and as far west as eastern Michigan. 9:08, the FAA bans all takeoffs nationwide for flights going to or through New York Center airspace. ABC News reports later that the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, the agency that runs New York area airports, asked the FAA for permission to close down the New York Center airspace. 9:13, the F-15 fighters from Otis Air National Guard Base leave military airspace near Long Island, bound for Manhattan. 9:14, President Bush returns to a holding room commandeered by the Secret Service shortly before. 9:15, the holding room contains a telephone, a television showing news coverage, and several senior staff members. The president speaks to Vice President Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice, New York Governor George Pataki, and FBI Director Robert Mueller, and prepares brief remarks. 9:17, the FAA closed down all New York City area airports. The city had initially asked the FAA to close down the airports. 9:17:02, CBS News correspondent Jim Stewart in Washington mentions that in the intelligence community, Osama bin Laden is a probable suspect. 9:21, all bridges and tunnels into Manhattan closed. 9:23, Flight 93 receives warning message text from United Airlines flight dispatcher Beware any cockpit intrusion. Two AC aircraft hit the World Trade Center. 924, FAA notifies NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector about suspected hijacking of Flight 77. The FAA and NORAD establish an open line to discuss Flight 77 and shortly thereafter after Flight 93. 925, the Otis-based F-15s establish an air patrol over Manhattan. At the same time, a video teleconference begins to be set up in the White House Situation Room, led by Richard Clark, a special assistant to the president that eventually includes the CIA, the FBI, Departments of State, Justice, Defense, and the FAA. 926, the FAA bans takeoff of all civilian aircraft regardless of destination, a national ground stop. All military bases in the United States are ordered to increase threat conditions to Delta status. Hijackers storm the cockpit on Flight 93 and take over the flight. Entry of the hijackers is overheard by flight controllers at Cleveland. President Bush makes his first public statements about the attack in front of an audience of about 200 teachers and students at the elementary school. He states that he'll be going back to Washington. Today we've had a national tragedy starts. Two airplanes have crashed into the World Trade Center in an apparent terrorist attack on our country, and leads a moment of silence. No one in the president's traveling party has any information during this time that other aircraft are hijacked or missing. At 9:32, a radio transmission from Flight 93 is overheard by flight controllers at Cleveland. Ladies and gentlemen, here is the captain. Please sit down. Keep remaining sitting. We have a bomb on board. At the same time, controllers at the Dulles Terminal Radar Approach Control in Virginia observe a primary radar target tracking eastbound at a high rate of speed, referring to Flight 77. 9:33 to 9:34. Tower supervisor at Reagan National Airport tells Secret Service Operations Center at the White House that an aircraft is coming at you and not talking with us, referring to Flight 77. The White House is about to be evacuated when the tower reports that Flight 77 has turned and is approaching Reagan National Airport. At 9:34, the FAA Command Center relays information concerning Flight 93 to FAA headquarters. The President's motorcade... 9:35, the President's motorcade departs from the elementary school, bound for Sarasota, Bradenton International Airport, and Air Force One. At 9:35, Flight 93 reverses direction over Ohio and starts flying eastward. At the same time, based on a report that Flight 77 had turned again and was circling back toward the District of Columbia, the Secret Service orders the immediate evacuation of the Vice President from the White House. 9:36, Cleveland advises the FAA Command Center that it is still tracking Flight 93 and inquires whether someone has requested the military to launch fighter aircraft to intercept the aircraft. 9:37, Vice President Cheney enters an underground tunnel leading to a security bunker. 9:37:46, Flight 77 crashes into the western side of the Pentagon at 530 miles an hour and starts a violent fire. The section of the Pentagon hit consists mainly of newly renovated, unoccupied offices. All 64 people on board are killed, as are 125 Pentagon personnel. 9:39, another radio transmission is heard from Ziad Jarrah aboard Flight 93. This is the captain. I would like you to all remain seated. We have a bomb on board, and we're going back to the airport and to have our demands, so please remain quiet. At 9:40, a video teleconference in the White House Situation Room begins with the physical security of the president, the White House, and federal agencies. They are not yet aware of the Pentagon crash. 9:42, Ben Sliney of the FAA issues an execution order for Skatana grounding of all air traffic over the United States and diverting any incoming international traffic to alternate destinations. At 9:43, Abu Dhabi TV reports it received a call from the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, claiming responsibility for the World Trade Center attack, but this is soon denied by a senior officer of the group. 9:43 again, the White House and Capitol are evacuated and closed. 9:45, United States airspace is shut down. No civilian aircraft are allowed to take off, and all aircraft in flight are ordered to land at the nearest airport as soon as possible. Nearly all international flights headed for the U.S. are redirected to Canada, while some flights from South America were diverted to Mexico. Transport Canada, Canada's transportation agency, also closes down its airspace, but the Mexican airspace did not shut down. The FAA announces that civilian flights are suspended till at least noon September 12th, while Transport Canada gives similar orders. The FAA further ordered that diverted U.S.-bound international flights should be taken in, launching the agency's Operation Yellow Ribbon. The groundings would eventually last until September 14th. Military and medical flights, as well as Con Air flights, continue. This is the fourth time all commercial flights in the United States has been stopped, and the first time a suspension was unplanned. All previous suspensions were military-related, Sky Shield 1 through 3 from 1960 to 1962. Many newspapers, including the New York Times, mistakenly print that this is the first time flights have been suspended. This was also the first time commercial flights in Canada have been stopped. 9:49. The FAA Command Center at Herndon suggests that someone at FAA headquarters should decide whether to request military assistance with Flight 93. Ultimately, the FAA makes no request before it crashes. 9:51. The Fire Department of New York Battalion Chief Oro Palmer reaches the 78th floor sky lobby of the South Tower along with Fire Marshal Ronald Buca. Palmer reports that there are two pockets of fire and numerous dead bodies. 9:52, the National Security Agency intercepts a phone call between a known associate of Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan and someone in the Republic of Georgia, announcing that he had heard good news and that another target was still to be hit. 9:55, Air Force One leaves Sarasota-Bradenton International Airport. 9:57, a passenger revolt begins on Flight 93. 9:58-59, the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapses 56 minutes after the impact of Flight 175. Its destruction is viewed and heard by a vast television and radio audience. 10 o'clock, moments after the South Tower fell, the Fire Department of New York Battalion Chief Joseph Pfeiffer inside the North Tower said on the radio the order to all firemen at least twice evacuate building. Due to many communication limitations, numerous firefighters within the tower did not receive this transmission. At 10:01, the FAA Command Center advises FAA headquarters that an aircraft had seen Flight 93 waving its wings, the hijackers' efforts to defeat the passengers' counterattack. 10:02, communicators with the vice president in the security bunker begins receiving reports from the Secret Service of an inbound aircraft, presumably hijacked, heading toward Washington. This is Flight 93. At 10:03 approximately, the National Military Command Center learns from the White House of Flight 93's hijacking. 10:03:11, United Airlines Flight 93 is crashed by its hijackers and passengers at 583 miles per hour due to fighting in the cockpit, 80 miles southeast of Pittsburgh in Somerset County, Pennsylvania. Later reports indicate that passengers had learned about the World Trade Center and Pentagon crashes on cell phones, and at least three were planning on resisting hijackers. The resistance was confirmed by the Flight 93's cockpit voice recording, on which the hijackers are heard making their decision to down the plane before the passengers succeed in breaching the cockpit door. 10:07. NEADS, controlling the only set of fighters over Washington, first learns of the hijacking of Flight 93 4 minutes after it actually crashed. 10:08, Air Traffic Control Systems Command Center in Herndon reports to FAA headquarters that Flight 93 may be down near Johnstown, Pennsylvania. At 10:17, the command center concludes it is so. 10:10, part of the west side of the Pentagon collapses. At the same time, NEADS emphatically tells fighter pilots over Washington negative clearance to shoot. 10:10 to 10:15, approximately, Vice President Cheney, unaware that Flight 93 has crashed, authorized fighter aircraft to engage inbound plane, reported to be 80 miles from Washington, based not on radar from which it has disappeared, but the speed and trajectory projections. At 10:14 to 10:19, a lieutenant colonel at the White House repeatedly relays to the NMCC that the vice president has confirmed that fighters are clear to engage inbound aircraft if they can verify that the aircraft was hijacked. 10:18, NBC reports that Yasser Arafat, chairman of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, has denied complicity in the attacks and is appalled by them. 10:20, President Bush aboard Air Force One tells Vice President Cheney that he has authorized a shootdown of aircraft if necessary. At 10:28:22, the North Tower of the World Trade Center collapses. Due to the destruction of the gypsum-encased stairwells on the impact floors, most skyscraper stairwells are encased in reinforced concrete. No one who was above the impact zone in the North Tower escapes the collapse. The Marriott Hotel, located at the base of the two towers, is also destroyed. The second collapse is also viewed live on television and heard on radio. The North Tower collapses 1 hour, 42 minutes after the impact of Flight 11, meaning that the building had burned during the whole duration of attacks. 10:31, NORAD first communicates the Vice President's shootdown authority to NEADS. 10:35, Air Force One carrying the president turns for Barksdale Air Force Base in Bossier City, Louisiana. 10:39, another hijacked jumbo jet is claimed to be headed for Washington, D.C. F-15s are scrambled and patrol the airspace above Washington, D.C., while other fighter jets sweep the airspace above New York City. They have orders first issued by Vice President Cheney and later confirmed by President Bush to shoot down any potential dangerous planes that do not comply with orders given to them via radio. Eventually, the aircraft is revealed to be a medevac helicopter on its way to Pentagon. 10:50:19, five stories of part of the Pentagon collapses due to the fire. 10:53, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld orders the U.S. military placed at DEFCON 3 for the first time since the Yom Kippur War in 1973. 11 a.m., Transport Canada halts all aircraft departures until further notice, except for police, military, and humanitarian flights as part of Operation Yellow Ribbon. 11:05, the FAA confirms that several planes have been hijacked in addition to American Airlines Flight 11. 11:16, American Airlines confirmed the loss of two aircraft. 11:26, United Airlines confirmed the loss of Flight 93 and states it is deeply concerned about Flight 175. 11:53, United Airlines confirmed the loss of its two aircraft. 11:55, the border between U.S. and Mexico is on highest alert, but is not closed. At 12:04, Los Angeles International Airport, the intended destinations of Flight 11, 77, and 75 is shut down. At 12:15, San Francisco International Airport, the intended destination of Flight 93 is shut down. Same time, the airspace over the 40 contiguous United States is clear of all commercial and private flights. At 12:30 approximately, Secretary of State Colin Powell boards a plane in Lima, Peru, bound for Washington, D.C. 12:39 on CNN, Senator John McCain characterizes the attack as an act of war. 12:41, Orrin Hatch tells CNN both the FBI and our intelligence community believe that this is bin Laden's signature. After this point, we're dealing with more of the aftermath of the attack. 1 p.m. at the Pentagon, fire crews are still fighting fires. The early response to the attack had been coordinated from National Military Command Center, but that had to be evacuated when it began to fill with smoke. 1:04, President Bush puts the U.S. military on high alert worldwide, known as Force Protection Condition Delta. Tape remarks from the president were aired from Barksdale Air Force Base, stating that freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward and freedom will be defended. He also said that the United States will hunt down and punish those responsible for these cowardly acts. Then he leaves for a U.S. Strategic Command bunker located at Offutt Air Force Base in Bellevue, Nebraska. At 2:50, President Bush arrives at Offutt Air Force Base, Bellevue, Nebraska, to convene a National Security Council teleconference via U.S. STRATCOM bunker. At 4 p.m., national news outlets report that high officials in the federal intelligence community are stating that Osama bin Laden is suspect number one. At 4:25, the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, and the American Stock Exchange report that they will remain closed Wednesday, September 12th. At 4:36, President Bush departs off at Air Force Base on Air Force One. At 5:20:33, 7 World Trade Center, a 47-story building collapses. The building contained New York's Emergency Operations Center, operated by the New York City Office of Emergency Management, originally intended to respond to disasters such as September 11th terrorist attacks. Due to the emergency personnel having more than enough time to evacuate the building since the collapse of the North Tower, there were no injuries or death result of the collapse. At 6 p.m., the last aircraft headed for the United States to land at a Canadian airport lands at Vancouver International Airport, since it was flying over the Pacific. At 6:54, President Bush arrives at the White House. At 8:30, President Bush addresses the nation from the White House. As Bush speaks, member of Congress tells CNN that during private briefings with senior administration officials, they were told that the administration had enough evidence that it was confident the attacks are the work of Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda terrorist network. At 9 p.m., President Bush meets his full National Security Council, followed roughly half hour later by a meeting with a smaller group of key advisors. Bush and his advisors have evidence that Osama bin Laden is behind the attacks. CIA Director Tenet says that al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Afghanistan are essentially one and the same. Bush says, "Tell the Taliban we're finished with them." Not too long after the attacks, out came the conspiracy theory. Now, numerous groups had formed up to what's commonly referred to as the 9/11 Truth Movement. I will focus on 4 primary groups. This will be the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, the makers of the movie Loose Change, scholars for 9/11 Truth, and the scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. The 9/11 scholars for 9/11 Truth Justice. Now, the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect of 25 years, a member of the American Institute of Architects, and the founder and CEO of Architects for 9/11 Truth, a 501c3 educational charity representing more than 2,000 degreed licensed architect and engineers who have signed petitions calling for a new independent investigation. Formed in 2006, Gage was able to recruit a number of engineers in Texas to sign a petition asking for a new investigation. Based on what I find, various anomalies concerning the collapse of World Trade Center 1 and 2 and 7. Personally, I've worked with a number of engineers and architects over the past 30 years. Many, if not all, for lack of a better word, they're a bit strange. Engineers and architects are very meticulous and detail-driven individuals. Engineers generally work within a particular specialty. Architects are generally a combination of structural engineers and artists. In both cases, these are professions that are licensed by various states or countries and basically liable for any accident that may be caused by their failure to do a proper design. So it doesn't really surprise me that Richard Gage, who is an architect, would question the collapse of these buildings. The architects that would have built the World Trade Center buildings would have been working from design parameters that should have accounted for such things as building weight, wind load, snow load, and an occasional object hit. And these design parameters would have been determined along with a safety factor, so in theory, an airplane hits, fires within the building, and other anomalies should have been accounted for in the original design parameter. This is probably what's driving Mr. Gage in his endeavor, that the building would collapse under the conditions that it did, is considered an anomaly. And like most good conspiracy theories, anomalies are very important in the basis for the conspiracy. Then we have Loose Change. Loose Change is a series of films released between 2005 and 2009, which argue that the September 11th attacks were planned and conducted by elements within the United States government, and base the claims on perceived anomalies in the historical records of the attack. The films were written and directed by Dylan Avery and produced by Corey Rowe, Jason Burmes, and Matthew Brown. The original 2005 film was edited and re-released as Loose Change, the second edition, and then subsequently edited a third time for the second edition recut, each time to tighten the focus on certain key areas and to correct some inaccurate claims and remove copyrighted material. Loose Change, the final cut, deemed the third and final release of the documentary series, was released on DVD and web streaming format on November 11, 2007. Another version of the film, Loose Change 9/11, An American Coup, released on September 22, 2009, is narrated by Daniel Sanjata and distributed by Microcinema International. Coverage for this film increased in 2006, with the recut release having airings on U.S. and European television stations and over 4 million views online in 4 months, leading Vanity Fair to say it could be the first internet blockbuster. Loose Change asserts that the unusual account of the Pentagon attack, World Trade Center collapse, and the United 93 phone calls and crash is implausible, and instead it suggests the 9/11 attacks were a false flag operation. The film's main claims have been refuted by journalists, independent researchers, and prominent members of the scientific and engineering community. Again, Loose Change in its various incarnations looked at anomalies primarily from media reports or questioned various aspects of the post-attack reports, generally not answering questions, just posing questions as facts and allowing the viewer to draw their own conclusions. And this would be the quintessential documentary that would launch and fuel the 9/11 conspiracy and truther movement. Now, this documentary would launch the careers of Dylan Avery and Jason Burmes. Avery would continue on as a filmmaker, producing various films, many available on YouTube. Jason Burmes will continue producing conspiracy-related films and would ultimately become a radio host himself on the GCN network. This is the same network that Alex Jones is involved with. Corey Rowe was not so lucky. On July 23, 2007, he was arrested at his home on Tanata, New York, based on a military warrant charging him with felony desertion. Then on Friday, January 28, 2011, Rowe was arrested with a 19-year-old Brooklyn man for allegedly selling heroin to an undercover police officer. Rowe was released on bail. So far, I have not been able to locate any information on the actual disposition of either case. And in this movie, it's also had its share of controversy. Charlie Sheen expressed an interest in narrating one of the versions of Loose Change, but this was before his first mental breakdown. Again, I can't find any corroborating evidence as to what was the situation. Scholars for 9/11 Truth. The original Scholars for 9/11 Truth, founded by James H. Fetzer and Stephen Jones on December 15, 2005, was a group of individuals of varying backgrounds and expertise who rejected the mainstream media and government accounts of the September 11th attacks. Initially, the group invited many ideas and hypotheses to be considered. However, leading members soon came to feel that the inclusion of some theories advocated by Fetzer, such as the use of directed energy weapons or small nuclear bombs to destroy the Twin Towers, were insufficiently supported by evidence and were exposing the group to ridicule. By December 2006, Jones and several others set up a new scholars group titled Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice, whose focus was in the use of scientific method in analysis. The original members took a vote on which group to join, and the majority voted to move to the new group. And then we have the Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice. Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice formed in January 2007. As a self-described group of scholars and supporters endeavoring to address the unanswered questions about September 11, 2000 attack through scientific research and public education. The group is composed by more than 900 members, including Richard Gage, Stephen E. Jones, Jim Hoffman, David Ray Griffin, Peter Phillips, former Congressman Daniel Hamburg, and Kevin Ryan. Most members support the conspiracy theory that the World Trade Center towers and the third skyscraper, WT-7, were destroyed through explosive demolition. In 2008 and 9, several Scholars for 9/11 Truth and Justice members published essays in science and engineering journals. In April 2008, a letter by members Stephen E. Jones, Frank Leggy, Kevin Ryan, Anthony Zambotti, and James Gourley was published in the Open Civil Engineer Journal. In July 2008, an article by Ryan, Gourley, and Jones was published in The Environmentalist. In October 2008, a comment by STJ members James Gourley describing what he considers fundamental errors in a Bansett and Vander paper was included in an issue of the Journal of Engineering Mechanics. And in April 2009, Danish chemist and STJ member Niels Harrit of the University of Copenhagen and 8 other authors, some also STJ members, published a paper in the Open Chemical Physics Journal titled Active Thermitic Material Discovered in Dust from the 9/11 World Trade Center Catastrophe. The paper, which caused the editor and only peer reviewer, Professor Pelini to resign, stating that this was published without her knowledge, thus adding to the numerous times that this dubiously peer-reviewed journal was accused of not peer-reviewing its publications. Concludes that chips consisting of unreacted and partially reacted nanothermite, also kind of called superthermite, appears to be present in samples of dust. And then we get into some of the secondary conspiracies. Now, the above helps support various other secondary level conspiracies. Most of these involve the war in Afghanistan and Iraq. This also includes alleged involvement by Israel. Others believe the attacks were staged in order to impose martial law, curtailment of privacy, and or remove constitutional rights as it relates to certain seizure, habeas corpus, and the use of the military as a police force. And others look at this as a corporate greed thing, again, along the line of the military-industrial complex. So in my future podcasts on 9/11, I'll get into more details on the secondary conspiracies, as these seem to be more prevalent than the above primaries.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
I have no real news for this time around. Podcast is doing pretty well. I'm well over 100,000 downloads now. It's getting close to 100,000 unique downloads. And looking at the numbers for December, I think almost hitting 10,000 downloads just in December. I think there's definitely people are liking this. So I do appreciate everyone listening. I have gotten some very nice feedback. Larry T asks about wanting me to do a show on TWA 800, Flight 800 and the conspiracy behind that. And I was actually planning on doing it for this episode, but I started reading a little bit more into it. And it actually kind of makes sense if I do it after the 9/11 show, because actually some information to support a show on TWA 800. Now, this is the passenger flight that was allegedly possibly shot down as it flew over Long Island in New York. So I'm gonna do that after. I think I'm gonna do that right after the 9/11 shows. And of course, Richard K has been definitely been a big supporter of my work here on this podcast and the BitSpot Report. I really do appreciate your feedback, and hopefully I can improve on a few things. The one thing about the BitSpot Report is it's kind of weird, because I guess I am not as pessimistic as Cephas is. I think basically here in the United States, we do have the ability to change things. Maybe it's maybe some of the 60s have rubbed off on me, what have you. It's almost like, even though we do have this conservative bent, and that's mainly what's interesting about the show, I do believe that with enough people deciding enough is enough, that we can change the way this country's run. So it does sound at times where I do sound a little tentative, because it's hard to, I guess, I have a rough time wanting to disagree with Cephas on some of his stuff. So it makes it interesting, and it kind of probably more of an exercise of keeping myself on my toes. But I do appreciate that comment. Other than that, the only other big news is that I am involved with another podcast that should be pretty close to, we should start issuing some audio on this. Every Saturday at noon Central Time in the United States, we have a hangout with the Irreverent Skeptics. And along with myself, there's John Omby, Brandy Madison, Michael McElroy, Erno Matila, and Chris, a.k.a. Dumbass. We do this a video chat, and then we're now actually going to convert it into a audio show. If you're interested, it's a Google Plus group, the Irreverent Skeptics. You should be able to find it either through my Google Plus. I should be posting stuff from that. We have a Twitter account, Irrev Skep. I'll put links to all this in my show notes. You'll find that at mikeboehler.com. That's MikeBoehler.com. be sure to check us out. You can watch us live. Eventually post it to YouTube. And ultimately, the ultimate goal is to get us on iTunes and the regular podcatchers, Stitcher and all that, probably at least by the end of the month. So be sure to check that out. Be sure to check out other the Dumbass Media programs. C-Web Sunday School, The Dumbass Guide to Knowledge, The Invisible Sky Monster, The Amateur Skeptics. So, and that's all the announcements I have. So, thank you for listening. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikeboehler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikeboehler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikeboehler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Tsarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.